Community College. My name is Mark Story. I'm the BCC Philosophy Club advisor, and the Philosophy Club welcomes you in particular. We're here tonight to attend a debate on the question, does God exist? Bill Fernandes on your left and Dan Barker on your right. I'm going to say a couple thank yous before I introduce these two fine guys. I'd especially thank the student government for supporting this financially. This is not really taxpaying for this. This is coming out of the student fees. And we want to consider this kind of Bellevue Community College's extension of an open marketplace of ideas. We really don't have a particular religious or a-religious agenda here. The Philosophy Club hopes to have many lectures and debates in the coming years covering topics that might be of interest to you, Bellevue Community College students, faculty, staff, and the surrounding community. I'd also like to thank John Wolfe in the Philosophy Department, Tom Nielsen in the Arts and Humanities Division, Ron Leatherbauer, and along with all the other BCC administrators who really supported the BCC Philosophy Club strongly over the last year and a half of existence. We want to thank them quite a bit. I'd like to introduce Phil Fernandes first. Phil's here on my left. He's senior pastor of Trinity Bible Fellowship and president and founder of the Institute of Biblical Defense. Both of these are based in Bremerton, Washington. He teaches at Columbia Evangelical Seminary in Longview and at Cascade Bible College in Bellevue. He earned a Bachelor of Theology from Forreston Theological Seminary, an MA in Religion from Liberty University, and a PhD in Philosophy of Religion from Greenwich University. He's published two books on these related topics. The first one, The God Who Sits Enthroned, Evidence for God's Existence. And the second one, No Other Gods, Defense of Biblical Christianity. Dan Barker, he's the Director of Public Relations for the Freedom from Religion Foundation, a columnist for the periodical Free Thought Today. He earned a degree in religion from Azusa Pacific University, and he's well published. He's published at least three books, Losing Faith in Faith from Preacher to Atheist, Just Pretend, a free thought book for children, and Maybe Yes, Maybe No, a Guide for Young Skeptics. So both these people are going to be well qualified to offer a defense for both sides of the position. Phil Fernandes will be taking the theist side, Dan Barker will be taking the non-theist side. Let me just tell you what the schedule will be like so you know what's going to be happening tonight. In approximately 2 hours. We'll have Fernandes opening with 20 minutes to present his position. Then there'll be 20 minutes for Barker to present his position. After that, Fernandes will have 10 minutes of rebuttal, and Barker will have 10 minutes of rebuttal. Following the rebuttal, there'll be some cross-examination. First, for 5 minutes, Fernandes will cross-examine Barker, and then for 5 minutes, Barker will cross-examine Fernandes. At that point, we've got a microphone here. You might be thinking of some questions. The audience will be able to ask questions of either one of the speakers. We are going to limit the questions to questions specifically directed to topics addressed tonight. So there may be many other issues surrounding philosophy of religion, the existence of God. We want to have the questions focus on these topics. Secondly, we'd like the questions focused. We had thought maybe we'd have you write the questions down to them, but Philosophy Club decided to have you just have the freedom to ask them yourselves. We're going to ask you that you get to the point, ask a question, and let these fine people have an opportunity to respond. If you don't, I'm not going to politely say, could you please come to your question? Please allow me that. To conclude, they'll each have 5 minutes for closing statements and remarks. And that should take us to about 2 hours. With that, I'd like to offer the podium to Fernandez. Thank you very much.
Thanks. I'd like to express my gratitude to Bellevue Community College for sponsoring this debate and Dan Barker for agreeing to debate me. I've chosen to utilize a cumulative case for God. This cumulative case will examine several different aspects of human experience that are more adequately explained by theism, the belief in a personal God, than by atheism, the rejection of the belief in a personal God. The thesis I seek to defend is as follows. It is more reasonable to be a theist than it is to be an atheist. For purposes of this debate, I will define God as the eternal uncaused cause of all else that exists, as being as personal, a moral and intelligent being, and unlimited in all his attributes. This being is separate from his creation, transcendent, but he is also involved with it, immanent. In short, I will argue that the God of theism exists. My first argument is from the beginning of the universe. This argument is as follows. Whatever began to exist must have a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe had a cause. Premise number one uses the law of causality. Non-being cannot cause being. In other words, from nothing, nothing comes. Since nothing is nothing, it can do nothing. Therefore, it can cause nothing. Hence, whatever began to exist needs a cause for its existence. Premise number two contends that the universe had a beginning. Scientific evidence for the beginning of the universe includes the second law of thermodynamics, energy deterioration, and the Big Bang model. The second law of thermodynamics is one of the most firmly established laws of modern science. It states that the amount of usable energy in a closed system is running down. This means that someday in the finite future, all the energy in the universe will be useless unless there is intervention from outside the universe. In other words, if left to itself, the universe will have an end. But if the universe is going to have an end, it had to have a beginning. At one time in the finite past, all the energy in the universe was usable. Since the universe is winding down, it must have been wound up. The universe is not eternal. It had a beginning. And since it had a beginning, it needs a cause. For from nothing, nothing comes. Due to energy deterioration, if the universe is eternal, it would have reached a state of equilibrium in which no change is possible an infinite amount of time ago. All of the universe's energy would already have been used up. Obviously, this is not the case. Therefore, the universe had a beginning. The Big Bang model also indicates that the universe had a beginning. In 1929, astronomer Edwin Hubble discovered that the universe is expanding at the same rate in all directions. As time moves forward, the universe is growing apart. But this means that if we go back in time, the physical universe would get smaller and smaller. Eventually, if we go back far enough in the past, the entire universe would be what scientists call a point of infinite density, or a point of dimensionless space. However, if something is infinitely dense, it is non-existent. For existent things can only be finitely small. Again, we're talking about the physical universe here. The same can be said for points of dimensionless space. If a point has no dimensions, it is non-existent, for it takes up no space. Therefore, if the Big Bang model is correct, it shows that the universe began out of nothing a finite time ago. This means that space, matter, and time had a beginning. There have been two main attempts to refute the beginning of the universe. First is called the steady state model, which entails matter popping into existence out of nothing. Because of the mounting evidence for the Big Bang model, this view has been abandoned by most of its adherents. The second attempt to evade the beginning of the universe is called the oscillating model. This model teaches that at some point in the universe's expansion, gravity will halt the expansion and pull everything back together again. From that point, there will be another Big Bang. This process will be repeated over and over again throughout all eternity. However, the oscillating model fails. First, there is no known principle of physics reverse the collapse of the universe and cause another bang. Second, current scientific research has shown that the universe is not dense enough to pull it back together again. And third, if it could be proven that several big bangs have occurred, the second law of thermodynamics would still require that there was a first big bang. Many scientists accept the beginning of the universe, but believe that it does not need a cause. The evidence proposed by these scientists consists of speculation dealing with quantum physics, the study of subatomic particle movement. Appeal is made to Heisenberg's principle of indeterminacy in order to claim that quantum particles pop into existence out of nothing entirely without a cause. However, Heisenberg's principle does not necessitate such an absurd interpretation. Simply because scientists cannot presently find the causes for quantum events does not mean that the causes do not exist. All that Heisenberg's principle states is that scientists are presently unable to accurately and simultaneously measure both the position and the momentum of a subatomic particle. If this principle proved that events can occur without causes, then this would destroy one of the pillars of modern science, the principle of causality. Every event must have an adequate cause. It seems obvious to me that the principle of causality is on firmer epistemological ground than the belief that things can pop into existence without a cause. Non-being cannot cause being. If the universe had a beginning, then it needs a cause. Besides the scientific evidence, there is also philosophical evidence for the beginning of the universe. If the universe is eternal, then there would be an actual infinite number of events in time. However, as Zeno's paradoxes have shown, it is impossible to traverse an actual infinite set of points. If we assume the existence of an infinite amount of actual points between two locations, then we can never get from location A to location B, since no matter how many points we have traversed, there will still be an infinite number of points left. If the universe is eternal, then there must exist an actual infinite set of events in the past, but then it would be impossible to reach the present moment. Since the present moment has been reached, there cannot be an actual infinite set of events in the past. There could only be a finite number, therefore there had to be a first event, hence the universe had a beginning. It should also be noted that if it is possible for an actual infinite set just outside of a mind, contradictions and absurdities would be generated. To illustrate this point, let us look at two infinite sets. Set A consists of all numbers both odd and even. Set B contains only all the odd numbers. Set A and set B are equal since they both have an infinite number of members. Still, set A has twice the number of members as set B since set A contains both odd and even numbers while set B contains only odd numbers. It is a clear contradiction to say that set A and set B have an equal amount of members, while set A has twice as many members as set B. Therefore, actual infinite sets cannot exist outside. Actual sets existing outside the mind can only be potentially infinite, not actually infinite. These sets can be added to indefinitely, still we will never reach an actual infinite by successive addition. Therefore, the universe cannot have an infinite number of events in the past. The universe had a beginning. Since the universe had to have a beginning, it had to have a cause, for from nothing, nothing comes. But if the universe needs a cause, what if the cause of the universe also needs a cause? Could we not have an infinite chain of causes and effects stretching backwards in time throughout all eternity? Obviously, the answer is no. For we have already shown that an actual infinite set existing outside of a mind is impossible. Therefore, an infinite chain of causes and effects is also impossible. There had to be a first uncaused cause of the universe. This uncaused cause would be eternal without beginning or end. Only eternal and uncaused existence can ground the existence of the universe. Several attributes of the uncaused cause of the universe can be discovered through examination of the universe. This debate, hopefully, is evidence that intelligent life exists in the universe. Since intelligence is a perfection found in the universe, the ultimate cause of the universe must also be an intelligent being, for intelligence cannot come from non-intelligence. No one has ever shown how intelligence could evolve from mindless nature. Morality also exists in the universe. For without morality, there would be no such thing as right and wrong. However, the moral judgments we make show that we do believe there are such things as right and wrong. Still, nature is non-moral. No one holds a rock morally responsible for tripping him. There is no way that mere molecules in motion could produce moral values. Since nature is non-moral, but morality exists in the universe, the cause of the universe must be a moral being. Therefore, the uncaused cause of the universe must be an intelligent, moral being. This means that God must be a personal being. Argument number two, the continuing existence of the universe. Experience shows us that limited dependent beings exist. These limited dependent beings need other beings for their continued existence. For example, I depend on air, water, and food to sustain my existence. However, adding limited dependent beings will never give us an independent and unlimited whole. Therefore, the sum total of limited dependent beings is itself limited and dependent. If each individual part of a floor is wood, then the whole floor will be wood. Likewise, if each part of the universe is dependent, then the entire universe is dependent. Hence, the ultimate cause of the continuing existence of all limited dependent beings must be unlimited and independent. There cannot be two or more unlimited and independent beings, since if there were, they would limit one another's existence, but then they would not be unlimited. Therefore, there can only be one unlimited and independent being. This being must have all its attributes in an unlimited way, otherwise it could not be an unlimited being. The being must be all-powerful, for he is the source of all the power in the universe. No other power can limit him. He is eternal, for he is not limited by time. He is everywhere present, since he is not limited by space. He is immaterial, since he is not limited by matter. This being must be all good, since he is not limited by evil. He must be all-knowing, since he is not limited by ignorance. Since mindless nature works towards goals, such as acorns always becoming oak trees and not something else, there must be an intelligent designer overseeing natural processes. Without intelligent design, nature's processes would be left to chance. There would be no orderly patterns that could be described as natural laws. Therefore, this infinite and intelligent being, whom all finite and dependent beings depend upon for their continued existence, must be an intelligent being. Argument number three, the design and order found in the universe. The order, design, and complexity found in the universe strongly imply that the universe is not a random, chaotic throwing together of atoms. Rather, it is the product of intelligent design. And as the product of intelligent design, it necessitates the existence of an intelligent designer. Contemporary scientists have found numerous evidences for design in the universe. A few examples will suffice. First, the slightest variation in the expansion rate of the universe would render the universe incapable of sustaining life. Second, British scientists Hoyle and Wickramasinghe estimated that the chances of life evolving from random shuffling of organic molecules is virtually zero. They calculated that there is only one chance in 10 to the 20th power to form a single enzyme, and just one chance in 10 to the 40,000th power to produce the approximately 2,000 enzymes that exist. However, Hoyle and Wickramasinghe point out that the production of enzymes is only one step in the generation of life. Therefore, they concluded there must be some type of cosmic intelligence to explain the origin of life. Hoyle compared the probability of life spontaneously generating from non-life as equivalent to the chances of a tornado randomly producing a Boeing 747. From a junkyard. The cell is the basic unit of life. The DNA molecule of a single-celled animal contains enough complex information to fill one volume of an encyclopedia. An explosion in a print shop will never by chance produce one volume of encyclopedia. That amount of information necessitates an intelligent cause. Also, the human brain contains more genetic information than the information found in the world's largest libraries. There is no way that this amount of information could be produced by mere chance. Intelligent intervention is needed. Third, astrophysicist Hugh Ross listed 25 narrowly defined parameters that the universe had to have in order for life to be possible. Ross also pointed out 32 narrowly defined parameters for life concerning the Earth, its moon, its sun, and its galaxy. For instance, if the distance between the Earth and the sun was to differ by just 2% in either direction, no life on Earth would be possible. These parameters for life on Earth clearly show evidence of design and purpose. Fourth, molecular biologist Michael Behe has shown that the irreducible complexity found on the molecular level cannot be explained by the atheistic evolutionary model. Intelligent design is the only adequate explanation. The theistic hypothesis of intelligent design is obviously more plausible than the atheistic hypothesis of random chance. My fourth argument, the existence of absolute moral values. We all make moral value judgments when we call the actions of another person wrong. When we do this, we appeal to a moral law. This moral law could not originate with each individual, for then we could not call the actions of another person, such as Adolf Hitler, wrong. The moral law is not a creation of each society, for then one society cannot call the actions of another society, such as Nazi Germany, wrong. The moral law does not come from a world consensus, for world consensus is often mistaken. The world once thought that the earth was flat, the sun revolved around the earth, and slavery was morally acceptable. Appealing to society or world consensus will never give us an adequate cause for the moral law and the moral judgments we make. Appealing to society or world consensus only quantitatively adds men and women. What we need is a moral law qualitatively above man. This moral law must be eternal and unchanging so that we can condemn the actions of the past, such as slavery, the Holocaust, and so forth. The moral law qualitatively above man is not descriptive of the way things are, as is the case with natural laws. The moral law must be prescriptive. It prescribes the way things ought to be. Prescriptive laws need a prescriber. Therefore, a moral lawgiver must exist, and this lawgiver must be eternal and unchanging. My fifth argument, the absurdity of life without God. What hope can an atheist offer mankind? People on their deathbeds don't usually call an atheist to comfort them. Normally a preacher or priest is summoned. Even if an atheist could guarantee us 70 years of happiness, what good would that be when compared with the eternity of non-existence that follows? If there is no God, then Hitler will not be punished for his evil deeds, and Mother Teresa will not be rewarded for her generous works of charity. If there is no God, then a million years from now, it would make no difference if you were a Hitler or a Mother Teresa. Everyone that you would have influenced would have ceased to exist. Can life have any ultimate meaning if there is no God? If non-existence is what awaits us, can we really make sense of life? You live and then you die. There are no eternal consequences. Hitler and Mother Teresa have the same destiny. We all finish our meaningless journeys in total nothingness. The famous atheist Bertrand Russell once wrote, "That man is the product of causes which had no prevision of the end they were achieving. That his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms. That no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave. That all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins." Immediately following that statement, Russell referred to his atheistic philosophy as the firm foundation of unyielding despair. Without God, life is without meaning. However, if there is a God, then there is hope. The God of the Bible guarantees the defeat of evil and the triumph of good. He guarantees that Hitler will receive his punishment and Mother Teresa will receive her reward. God gives life meaning, for how we choose to live our lives on earth brings eternal consequences. God is our reason to be optimistic about the future. Without God, there is no hope. My final argument is the failure of atheism. I've already shown that theism better explains these other factors, but also it should be noted that atheism cannot adequately explain the laws of logic and mathematics, though both are needed for scientific investigation to begin. Atheism has no way to justify respect for human life, and it cannot offer a plausible explanation for human free will and human responsibility. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil Fernandez. Dan Barker will now have 20 minutes for his opening statement.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you, Phil. It's nice to be back in Seattle again. I brought an umbrella. There are millions of good Americans who do not believe in a God, who feel no need for a belief in a God, who live happy, productive, moral, meaningful lives without a belief in a God or spirit world or the hereafter. I'm one of them. I used to believe strongly. I dedicated my life to preaching the gospel. I was ordained to the ministry and I preached for 19 years, traveling in Mexico, traveling the country, winning souls for the kingdom. I believed 100%. The Bible said you should be a doer of the word, not a hearer only. And I was a doer. I was out, thinking the world was going to end any moment, knocking on doors, putting my life to the test and putting the Christian life to the test. And I liked most of it. I thought it was great. I didn't have any bitterness. I didn't have any horrible things happen to me, except I went through a process of reevaluating things intellectually and I changed my mind. That wasn't easy to do. And that's not why I'm here tonight, to tell you my story. If you want to know it, you can read my book called Losing Faith and Faith, From Preacher to Atheist. After I became an atheist, I discovered there's just a wonderful subset of humans who live great lives without a belief in a God. In this country, there's at least 25 million. And here in the Seattle area, it's about 1 out of 4 people who don't believe in a God. It's the highest rate of unbelief in the entire country, which is something you ought to be proud of here, you know? An atheist is simply a person who does not believe in a God, for whatever reason, and there are a lot of reasons. The reasons I'm going to give tonight are mine. There are others. But the primary reason that we atheists don't believe in a God is that there is no evidence for a God. There's never been any evidence, well, except for maybe claims to miracles and prayer, but we didn't hear any of those things tonight. Notice that of all of Phil's eloquent statements, he did not give us any evidence for his hypothesis. Notice what he gave us tonight. Words and more words for, not for a God, but for a certain gap in human understanding. How did the universe start? What's the origin of moral values? He didn't give us any positive evidence for his hypothesis. He simply showed us a bunch of holes in our understanding and then decided, let's plug those holes with my particular God. There are all sorts of gods you can plug those holes with. Philosophers call this the God of the gaps, and humans have been playing that game for centuries and centuries. There was thunder and lightning, and primitive people thought, what is that? They didn't know what it was. It must be a god. Thor, Zeus. But now we understand electricity. We know more about the weather. Thor and Zeus are dead. We don't need those. Those gaps have been closed by science. Brilliant minds can come up against a gap and wonder, what's the answer? 300 years ago, Isaac Newton, a brilliant scientist, he believed in a god, but the brilliant cutting-edge scientist of his day, more than 300 years ago, he figured out the orbits of the planets and gravitation and all that. It was a huge leap forward for the human race. But Isaac Newton, after figuring all that out with his brilliant mind, was stumped by a couple of things. He couldn't figure out why were all the planets going in the same direction and why were they all in the same plane. And the brilliant scientist Isaac Newton said, you know what, there's no answer to that. There is evidence of design in the universe. He came right out and said it. Isaac Newton, we now look back and we can smile. We can say, well, we now know about the formation of solar systems and planets, and now we know you were wrong. That was a gap in his mind back then, which he plugged with his God. Today, there are plenty of gaps in our understanding. Cosmologists are struggling with these gaps. How do we answer this question? Is superstring theory the theory of everything, or isn't it? And on and on. Is the inflationary universe a good model? There are a lot of huge gaps in understanding, but is Phil going to stand up here and say to the world, we have now reached the end of science? Are you going to tell the scientists of 300 years from now that they can't ever come to an understanding of the cause of the universe. Now we have reached it, and therefore your God is the answer. I don't think so. I think we should humble ourselves a little bit and realize we have a lot more to learn. And simply plugging a gap with an unproved hypothesis doesn't do the trick for a philosophical mind. Another reason I don't believe in a God is because the whole idea of a God is not coherent. In order for any statement to be true, it must be in principle falsifiable. Karl Popper was one of the first to articulate this idea. That means that if a statement is true, there must be statements that you can make about that statement which, if true, would make this statement false. If we routinely discovered fully developed horse skeletons in the ancient Precambrian strata with the trilobites, that would be one way of falsifying evolution. If we look for those things and fail to find them, then that strengthens the hypothesis of evolution. But no one has ever presented any falsifiable statements for the God concept. In other words, what is it that would prove you wrong? And how do we go about showing that those proofs have failed? During cross-examination, Phil, I'm going to ask you tonight to provide us with an example of a statement which, if true, would make your hypothesis false. Okay? And if you want to ask me the same thing, I've got a couple dozen that I would give to you. If the statement is not falsifiable in principle, then you cannot say that it's a true hypothesis. So since it's your hypothesis, it's not mine. We atheists didn't come up with the God concept. You theists came up with it. It's your idea. It's your hypothesis. The burden of proof is on your shoulders. And if you want me to prove that it's wrong, then tell me what you would accept as a proof. What would you accept as a proof that your hypothesis is wrong? So far, that has never been offered by anyone that I've talked to. Another evidence that there is no God, and again, my case is cumulative like yours, is the fact that if there is a God, why is it that there's no agreement about this God? Why is it that there are so many competing theologies? Why is it that no two believers can agree about this God? Paul in the Bible wrote very clearly, God is not the author of confusion. Yet never has a single book caused more confusion than the Bible. Isn't that true? Look at all these competing denominations, and they can each show to you ours is the true one and the others are all wrong. They can all prove it to you biblically. They have the proper concept of God. If there's a God and he wants us to know about him, then why is it so confusing? What do you think is more natural, given this undoubtable confusion, that there really exists this all-powerful deity who cares about us and wants his creatures to know who he is, or that the God concept is the natural product of diverse human fears, wants, needs, and cultures? Another evidence that there is no moral lawgiver in the world, and that there are no moral absolutes, in fact, it's a little bit of rebuttal to what you brought up, is the fact that if there are absolute moral values, then why is it that no one knows who they are, what they are? No one knows what these values are. Take any crucial social moral issue of the day, you name it, you will find devout, God-fearing, Bible-believing, sincere praying Christians come down on both sides of those issues. Take the death penalty. Am I right? Take abortion rights. Take gay rights. Take doctor-assisted suicide. Good, strong, praying Christians fall down on different sides of those issues. Take euthanasia. Take women's rights or birth control or war versus pacifism. Take corporal punishment of your children or environmental protection. Gun control. Right? You name the issue, you will find believers falling on different sides. So where are these absolute moral values? Where are they? If there's a God who cares enough to communicate to us that there are absolute moral values, why did he do such a sloppy job of it? Why didn't he tell us? That is an evidence that he does not exist. I think one of the easiest ways to show that God does not exist is just walk into any children's hospital. Look at the kids in the children's hospital. Innocent children, suffering, hurting, through no fault of their own. Parents desperate for this health and safety of their children. Parents praying desperately to their God, whatever their God is, and many of these children dying and continuing in pain. If there is an all-powerful, all-caring God who exists, why doesn't he do something about that? Suppose you had known what was in the mind of Timothy McVeigh on that morning that he drove down to Oklahoma City. Timothy McVeigh was not an atheist, by the way. He was a member of a Catholic church. Boy, can you imagine what the media would have done with that? If Timothy McVeigh had been an atheist, you would have, the pulpits of America would have been saying, see, look at, atheism leads to such immorality and disregard for life. But he was a believer in God. What if you had known what was in his mind? What if you had seen that truckload of explosives? What if you had seen those children going into the daycare that morning? What if you had seen the parents of most of those children praying for God's protection in their lives? And what if you could have reached out with no risk to yourself and stopped that detonation from happening? Would you have done it? I would have. Would you? Would you, Phil? Would you have stopped it?
Oh, yeah, I would have.
Yeah, okay. Well, you're nicer than God.
Not as smart, though.
Because God supposedly knew all this. God supposedly answered the prayers of those parents. God supposedly cares about human values and human suffering. He could have stopped that detonation with no risk to himself, but he did nothing. In my book, that counts as something of an accomplice. I don't know if legally he's an accomplice, but at least morally, he would be something of an accomplice. That is one evidence. The existence of evil in the world is one of the strong evidences of it. A God does not exist, or at least a good God. Maybe there's a God exists and he's just a big pain in the butt. I mean, maybe he's an evil God. Maybe he gets his kicks out of toying with us. We atheists hear it all the time. What if you're wrong? What if you die and you're going to end up going to hell, you know? Have you ever thought about it? It's like we've never thought about this before. What if you're wrong? Oh, my goodness. But you could play the same game. What if you believers are wrong? What if there really is a God, but he's only going to reward those people who have enough courage not to believe in him? Huh? What if that's true? And what if you're wrong? And we atheists would be very surprised someday, wouldn't we? But, you know, you can play this game of what if you're wrong and all this evil and that, but, and hell, what a horrible concept. Any ideology, any system of thought that is based on violence and intimidation is a morally bankrupt system. The Christian system, the traditional theistic system, is based on intimidation, threats, violence, eternal torment, punishment, you better be good or else. That's morally bankrupt. We moral individuals have an obligation to reject such nonsense and embrace kindness and reason. Here's another reason why I reject the existence of a God, because the way gods are defined, the way the traditional Western God is defined, he has characteristics which are mutually incompatible. For example, he's supposedly perfect, yet he created a world. He created a world, why? Because he wanted to. Can a perfect being have wants and needs? To have a want and a need is to lack something. So apparently God wasn't perfect, or he wouldn't have needed to create something else. Some incompatible properties of God include his personhood. I'm going to skip a lot of this. There's about 13 of these incoherency arguments when you try to put this characteristic of God with this one. But let me move on to one that I call the free will argument for the non-existence of God, or for short, F-A-N-G, Fang. Goes like this. God is defined as a personal being. The traditional Western God is a personal being who knows everything. A personal being, like you and me, are beings that are capable of making decisions. We can make choices. If you can't make a choice, if you don't have at least the potential of making a choice, you're not really a personal being. You might be a robot or something, but free will requires having at least two options, more than one option, each of which is avoidable. And in order to have free will, you have to be able to effect your decision during a state of uncertainty and a period of potential. I might choose coffee, I might choose tea. Maybe I think I know, but if I have free will, I have a potential of changing my mind before I get there, right? That's one of the things that makes us personal. But if you know everything, if you're a God and you know everything about the past, the present, and the future, including all your future choices. If you're a God who's omniscient, you know what you're going to do tomorrow at 12 noon. Therefore, when tomorrow at 12 noon comes, you don't have a choice. If you change your mind anyway, you weren't omniscient, right? So how can an omniscient being have free will and be a personal being? It can't be. For God, there is no period of potential. For a God who knows everything, he is stuck. He's a slave. He's more deterministic than any robot because he knows the future. The future is fixed. The future can't be changed. Therefore, he's just going through the motions, isn't he? And I would not call that a personal being. Therefore, a being who knows everything does not have free will. So if God is defined as a personal being who knows everything, he can't exist. That thing is an oxymoron. It can't exist. And if it can't exist, then it doesn't exist. Some other ones, God is supposedly all just, and yet God is supposedly all merciful. What is justice? To be all just means you're always dispensing punishment that matches the severity of the crime exactly, right? That's what justice is. You don't send a kid to life imprisonment for stealing cookies, right? Justice requires matching this crime with the severity of the punishment. But mercy means that you are dispensing punishment with less severity than is deserved. So if God is all just, he can't be all merciful. And if he's all merciful, he can't be all just. Omniscience and omnipotence. If God knows everything, that means that he knows every one of his thoughts, and he knows all of his thoughts that he's ever known. In fact, he knows every thought that he's thinking, and he knows that he's thinking every thought that he's thinking. Logically, he gets into an infinite regress. If God's eternal, how can he possibly have known every eternal thought that he's ever had? It would take him an eternity to remember an eternity. Besides that, he spent all this time just remembering to eternity and not doing anything. Besides that, if God knows everything, how does God know that there are not some things that he doesn't know? How would an omniscient being know that that's it? Maybe there's some things he doesn't. How could somebody, anyone possibly know everything? Now, Phil talked about cosmology and shot himself in the foot. I think some of you noticed it. Phil, quote, here's one of his quotes exactly. Existent things can only be finitely small. You said that, right?
But then I...
You said that, right? Existent things can only be finitely small. Is God an existent thing? According to you, God is an existent thing. And yet, according to your reasoning, existent things can only be finitely small. If something has no space dimension, then it does not exist, you said. But God is not made of matter or space or time. Apparently, according to you, God is something outside of space and time. So according to you, since God has no spatial dimension, he does not exist. You said actual infinite sets cannot exist outside the mind. Well, is the mind of God infinite? Is the mind of God an actually infinite set? Or is it just a theoretical conceptual set? I think your argument is proving, if it proves anything, it's proving that God is a concept. Because you said that actual infinite sets only exist within the mind. So if God is actually infinite, he exists only in the mind. And you're basically proving what we atheists have always been saying. God is a concept in the mind. You said nothing comes from nothing. A very popular phrase, but a very suspicious phrase. If nothing comes from nothing, let me ask you, is God not nothing? Is God something? If something has to come from something, God is something, and you're still not off the hook there. Besides that, you didn't define the word nothing. What do you mean by nothing? Some people often ask me, can something come from nothing? And you can answer yes. And Phil gave a good example of that. If you define nothing as a vacuum, I don't know how else we would define it. Maybe there's other definitions. But if you define nothing as a vacuum, then yes, something does come. Matter does spontaneously pop into existence in a vacuum according to quantum fluctuations and usually annihilates itself again. So if that's your definition of nothing, then yes, something can come from nothing. If you have a different definition of nothing, then please give it to us tonight, because otherwise it's an incoherent statement. Besides that, you refer to the laws of thermodynamics, and you use the second law of thermodynamics a lot, and you assume that it applies to the universe. Well, what about the first law? The first law of thermodynamics states very clearly that the amount of matter and energy in the universe is fixed. It's the law of conservation. You can't add to it or take from it. Therefore, it would be more accurate to say that nothing comes from something. That makes a lot more sense. If you have something, you can't have something more. It's conservation.
1 minute.
So nothing comes from something. It would be a more accurate statement here. There are many ways for something to exist, right? We can all think of billions of ways for something to exist. How many ways are there for nothing to exist? Only one. So what's more likely? Why do we assume that reality, if left unperturbed, would degenerate into nothingness? What is this power that nothing has? Why don't we assume that something is the power, that something exists? And in fact, something does exist. And if something comes from something else, then God being something has to come from something else. I will continue with more rebuttals of Phil's arguments later. We're trying to rush through a quick debate tonight, and we're looking forward to questions from all of you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Dan Barker. Just let me give a quick note. The people standing by the door, if you would like to sit on the floor down here, please come in. Please come on in. We want to try to keep the doorway clear. We're now going to have rebuttal. Fernandes will offer a 10-minute rebuttal, and then Dan Barker.
Okay, basically I argued for the evidence, scientific and philosophical evidence for the beginning of the universe, that shows that the universe needs a cause, and the cause of the universe must be non-spatial, immaterial, non-temporal, and extremely powerful. If you believe nothing caused the universe, then I guess you would have an all-powerful nothing. There are several things that I need to touch on here. When he stated that, I said that everything must be infinitely small, I threw in something that was not in the text of my statement because I realized what he realized. And I basically stated, I'm talking about the physical universe, physical things, okay? When we examine physical things in nature, okay, then we see that something cannot get infinitely small, okay? And so basically, I don't see any problem with that particular point. Now, he rejects absolute moral values. He means ultimately there is no distinction between right and wrong. Yet he rejects Christianity as being immoral. Sounds like he's borrowing some capital from the Christian worldview. He says there's no good evidence for God's existence. It's a God of the gaps, a gap in human understanding. Now, I think a strong case for God's existence can be made and has been made based upon what we do know, not based upon what we do not know, as in the cases of Zeus and Thor. We do know the Big Bang. We do know the second law of thermodynamics. We do know infinite set theory. We do know intelligent design, and that moral absolutes are real, at least when we're wronged, and things of that sort. So I think that it's based upon, my arguments are not based upon an epistemological gap, a gap in knowledge, but a metaphysical, real gap, a gap between nothing and the entire universe. If rabbits can't pop into existence totally out of nothing without a cause, then what makes anybody think that the entire universe popped into existence by nothing, totally, without a cause? An atheist don't like to admit their own gaps, but they either have to hold to an eternal universe without any evidence for it, or they have to believe the universe popped into existence out of nothing, totally without a cause, yet no one's ever proven that it could take place, as absurd as it is. Life from non-life, spontaneous generation, it violates the law of biogenesis and the cell theory. Multi-celled animals or single-celled animals, all these things are evolutionary assumptions, okay? The evolution from fish, from the gills of fish, the transitional form would not even be able to breathe, okay? The evolution between reptiles and birds, totally different types of lungs. And lungs don't work unless they're fully developed. So you have, imaginary transitional forms that don't really exist. But everywhere there's a gap in evolution, evolutionists just side with what I would call chance of the gaps. They just cling to this belief that their evolution is true. And basically, I think it's a bias. I mean, I think we saw Dan's bias. He argued that, he said that we could only know, basically said that we could only know the theistic God exists. If we knew that God, the theistic God exists, science would come to an end. Who says? Modern science was founded by theists because they believe that a reasonable God created the universe in a reasonable way and man in his image as a rational being so that through reason man could find out about the universe in which we live. That's how science got jump-started. That's not how it comes to an end. Unless, of course, you a priori assume that science can only look for natural causes. It can never look, it can never accept a supernatural cause. But when the Big Bang shows that time, space, matter had a beginning, when all of nature needs a cause, the only option we have, the only two options we have, are either nothing or the supernatural. Because if all of nature needs a cause, that's all she wrote. He says that theism is non-falsifiable. I think he's appealing to Anthony Flew's Invisible Gardener's falsification principle. If the falsification is through the five senses, then we're right back to A.J. Ayer's verification principle, that something is only meaningful if it's proven by the five senses or true by definition. Well, the verification principle itself is not, can't be verified by the, through the five senses, and it's not true by definition, so it refutes itself. But whatever the case, I believe there's strong evidence for God's existence. I provided that evidence in my opening statement, and so I think theism is, in principle, falsifiable. Refute my arguments. Deal with my arguments, okay? Free will argument against God. Modal logic deals with possible worlds. We're not talking about the multiple universes that some scientists are speculating about. It deals with possible worlds in the realm of reason and all, and impossible, necessary, and contingent beings. But a clear distinction is drawn between what must be done and what will be done, what someone wills to do. It is no contradiction to say that God eternally and infallibly foreknows future human free choices. If we're free to choose differently, but if we choose differently, God's foreknowledge would have been different. And God, by the way, just because God can't do evil, that doesn't mean that God is not free. He was free to not create, and he chose to create. He was free to redeem or to not redeem, and he chose to redeem. Evil and human suffering, he pointed out, talked about going to children's hospitals, and many pastors like myself do go to hospitals and visit the sick and offer them comfort. But most contemporary philosophers, even atheists, have admitted that God and evil are not, an all-powerful, all-good God and evil, are not mutually exclusive. You see, Mr. Barker wrongly equates our failure to know why God allowed innocent human suffering, he equates that with God not having any good reasons for allowing innocent human suffering. Now, he offers no evidence for this bold claim. Okay? And he talks about tragedies. Yes, I believe those are tragedies. Yes, I would have stopped the Oklahoma City bombing. And he said I was nicer than God. I'll tell you one thing, I am not. I am not as knowledgeable as God. Mr. Barker would like us to believe that basically he is so wise that he is able to comprehend all the possible reasons why an infinite God might allow evil and human suffering, and he has judged them all as inadequate. So thank you, Mr. Barker, for having that infinite wisdom to be able to know what an infinite being, if he existed, would know, to be able to rule out every possibility that would be open to an infinite being. I think there's a problem of evil for atheists, because there's no way to call the world unjust unless one admits to a standard of justice outside and above the world. Anytime he called, he likes to talk about, Timothy McVeigh and things of that sort. The fact of the matter is, no God, no moral values, and no moral absolutes. Friedrich Nietzsche, that was his view. He was an atheist. Bertrand Russell, outside human desires, there are no moral values. A.J. Ayers, when we express moral values, all we're talking about is our emotions, our feelings. It's not based in truth. I think clearly we do know. The problem of evil, I think, is it's more than rational. It is an existential problem. So we need a real solution. Okay? And I see no real solution to the problem of evil apart from the existence of the God of the Bible and redemption through Jesus Christ. I am a Christian theist. But I believe that God gave man free will. We abuse this freedom. God allowed the consequences of those bad choices to set in, and so bad things happen. Horrible things happen. And I don't know why God allows every single case of evil and human innocent human suffering. But one thing I can tell you, atheists have no basis within their worldview to call anything evil in any absolute sense. The fact that theists can call the Holocaust absolutely evil makes theism more plausible than atheism. He talked about the first law of thermodynamics. Well, the first scientists can't say nothing could ever be created. They're saying nothing is now being created or destroyed. No energy is presently being created or destroyed. That's all it says, understood probably. It says God can't be all just and all merciful. Yes, God can remain all just, but he cannot forgive sin unless it's been paid for in full. And the Christian theist sees the Lord Jesus as paying the price in full. He says Christians and other theists don't agree on moral values. That's not the point. The fact that we agree that there are moral values, there are moral absolutes, but that entails the existence of an absolute moral law giver.
Some philosophers call it the composite fallacy. He says that if you look at the universe, you see that every event had a cause, therefore the universe had a cause. It doesn't work that way. You can't take an observation obtained from one level within a set and then apply that finding to the set as a whole, jumping up a logical sphere. In the same debate, Bertrand Russell pointed that out in 1948. For example, just because every member of an orchestra plays in harmony with every other member of that orchestra, does that mean that that orchestra plays in harmony with every other orchestra? That's senseless to talk about. Let's use your example. Just because every member of the set of even numbers is separated from its immediate neighbor by a distance of two, absolute two, does that mean that the set of whole numbers is separated from other sets by a distance of two? That's silly. I mean, it's a non-question. Yet that's exactly what you are doing. The universe is the set of all things, everything that exists. And you are taking observations within that set and trying to apply them to the set as a whole. You're trying to take the laws of thermodynamics, which are obtained within the set, and then trying to say, well, the set itself must also apply, like your rebuttal of the oscillating universe, as assuming that the laws of thermodynamics must obtain between sets rather than within a set. But that can backfire on you. For example, every event within the natural universe had a cause that is natural. Are you therefore going to say that the universe had a cause that is natural? Are you going to apply that finding to the universe? You don't. You're not consistent. You assume that the cause of the universe is supernatural. The principle of causality requires natural causes. That's what causality means. And for you to pretend like there's some kind of a transcendent or supernatural cause is completely irrelevant. You're jumping up to the wrong logical sphere. The universe is not a thing. To treat the universe like it's some kind of an object, this universe is a set of all things, yet you act like the universe is a member of its own set. You can't do that. And according to set theory, a set can be a subset of itself, but a set is never a member of itself. A set can be a member of other sets, but the universe is not a member of itself. So there's a fallacy in your thinking there when you're trying to apply findings within the universe to the universe as a whole. Therefore, no matter what happens in the universe, in anything that had a beginning within the universe, it makes no sense to say that the universe itself, even if it did have a beginning of sorts, must follow the same kind of rules of causality as the objects within it. Now, this talk about the fine-tuning of the initial constants. If the constants had been slightly different here or there, you hear this a lot. These design arguments sort of remind me of the person who says, how do you explain the fact? It's amazing. Look at all these rivers that were made to flow right along the state borders. How did they do it? What an amazing feat of engineering that must have been. And then when they veer off, they head right for the major cities. How did they make that happen? It's thinking backwards. Here's a good example. Suppose you're on death row, and you're going to be executed. They put a blindfold over you, they tie you up to the stake, and they say, we're going to execute you today, and we have 100 expert riflemen up there, and they've never missed so far. that will be doing the execution. So you hear, ready, aim, fire, and you hear the shots, but nothing. You're still there. You're still breathing. I would say that's a pretty amazing... I think Phil would mischaracterize us atheists as saying, well, it was just chance, it was my lucky day, right? None of us would say that. If that happened to me, I wouldn't say, boy, that was just luck, blind chance. Boy, I sure got out of that one. That would cry out for an explanation, wouldn't it? You would want to know what happened, you know? Or was there a conspiracy, maybe? Did they all misfire on purpose? You would want to know what happened. Well, then you take your blindfold off, and then you learn there's 101 prisoners. There you go. You know, you couldn't predict that you would be the one that would survive, but if there's 101 prisoners and 100 riflemen, well, then somebody's going to survive. It might not have been you. Or like that woman on Who Wants to Marry a Millionaire. She was hoping not to be chosen, you know, but she got picked anyway. She was the unlucky one. And so many, many cosmologists seriously entertain the possibility of multiple universes. And you know that's true. You can't prove such a thing, but I submit that your own argument implies such a thing. Because how can you compute the likelihood of any of the constants? You talk about these constants being what they are, and what if they had been different, there'd be no life. First of all, how do you know they could have been different from what they are? And then by how much? By how much could they have been different? And then how in the world do you compute the likelihood? The only way to use the word likelihood or probability in that context is to presuppose the potentiality of multiple universes, because the only way to compute a probability is to add up the numbers and divide, right? So you are assuming in your argument at least the potentiality of multiple universes. And how do you count them? How many multiples? It's senseless to talk about the likelihood of any of these initial constants unless you have some kind of a database that you're working from. So I submit that even you are agreeing with the idea of an ensemble of universes, either oscillating in time or multiple universes through the inflationary theory universe or some other ideas. It's true that we'll never get data from any of those universes, but we'll never be able to talk to any of those 100 death row people who were shot as well. I mean, we're the ones who survived. We're the ones who are here. If functional complexity requires a designer, as you seem to be supposing, like the human eye or evolution or whatever, if it requires a designer, my watch is ticking, I assume there was somebody that designed it, or a team of people, if that's true, that functional complexity requires a designer, isn't the mind of God functionally complex? Is it just a bunch of random thoughts? Or is the mind of God functioning in an orderly manner? If your argument is true, then God needs a designer as well. In fact, there's an awful lot of sloppy design in the universe, I think, if you look around. I think one of the strongest evidence for the existence of a God would be if he had given us a sensible calendar. What day is today, by the way? Right? February 29th, leap year. And some of you know that this day only happens once every 400 years. A leap year on a century only happens once every 400 years. Our calendar, why couldn't God have made the rotations and the revolutions of the earth match up to nice even numbers? And the moon going. That would have been an interesting evidence of design. But instead we see a lot of chaos. We see randomness. We see lack of design. We see things falling apart. We don't see that much design in the universe. And even the human being. The human eye is a very poorly designed eye compared to other species. The retina are backwards in our eye, but in other, like octopuses, the eye is better designed. Oh, I don't have much time here now for moral values. I never said that moral values don't exist. You're shooting a straw man. I think moral values do exist. I don't think they are absolute or objective. A moral value, an objective moral value is an oxymoron. Objective moral values cannot exist. Why? Because a value is a function of a mind. To value is a verb. It's a functioning of a mind, and the mind is itself a function. But to be objective means that something exists independently of a mind. So how can you have an objective, subjective thing? Objective values cannot exist by definition. But most of us atheists find an objective basis for moral values, very real moral values. And basically, there's not a list of moral values. If there is, how many are there? Are there 117? 246? What? How many did God create when he created the universe? There's only one important moral principle that most of us non-believers hold to, and that is the avoidance of unnecessary harm. You don't need a list. You don't need a bunch of values and codes because it changes. There are times when your action will be different depending on the situation. I already pointed out that the values must not exist to Christians because they can't agree among themselves what they are. Every Christian knows that ethics are situational. Every Christian knows that sometimes it's the right thing to do to tell a lie. You can't make an absolute moral statement that all lying is wrong. Sometimes the situation calls for it. And even the God of the Bible endorsed lying on occasions. Adolf Hitler, by the way, was a Christian. He was a member of the Catholic Church. He credited Jesus as the source of his inspiration for exterminating the Jews on many occasions. He was not an atheist. But besides that, a lot of the things that he endorsed, slavery and that, were endorsed by the Bible itself. Your type of morality is a might makes right morality. God is the ultimate authority that tells us what we must do or else we're going to be punished. If you look at the God of the Bible, of course, we see an immensely immoral creature, a very bad role model to follow. One of the reasons I rejected Christianity is because I am nicer than God, and so are you. I disagree with your definition of evil. It's a self-serving definition. Evil is not the perversion of that which is good. Evil, basically, is just it's just a word. There's no cosmic things out there. The unnecessary harm in the world, whether it's moral or natural, is what good people try to avoid and try to eliminate. It's just a concept. And I think my time's up. Is that right? I guess it is. Okay.
We're now going to have a cross-examination. I'm just going to stay at the tables for 5 minutes. Fernandez will be cross-examining Barker, and then for 5 minutes, Barker will be examining Fernandez. Scott, I'll just be watching you for the time. Thanks.
Okay, Dan. First, can you give me any empirical evidence for explosions producing states containing more order and complexity?
Well, if you follow current cosmology, I guess the Big Bang would be one.
But we're trying to argue about the Big Bang, so my question again is, can you give me any empirical evidence for explosions, not assumptions, but some empirical evidence for explosions producing states containing more order and complexity? I mean,
I can think of one.
You're arguing in a circle if you're saying...
I can think of one. We run out of milk, and I got to get some milk, so I drive to the store. There's an explosion happening in that engine, and it got me some milk in my refrigerator. Well, there's an example, isn't it? It's a controlled explosion.
You'd have to agree that an engine is designed by intelligence.
Yeah, I think so.
So that was a pretty good theistic argument. Thank you. You said you don't believe in absolute universal moral laws, so correct me if I'm wrong, you do not believe that rape and racism are absolutely universally wrong.
What a horrible thing to say. Is that what you think atheists think? I believe in the existence of real moral values relative to human needs. The avoidance of unnecessary harm is a very strong moral principle, better than theistic morality. I believe that rape is wrong because it causes unnecessary harm. I think that even Christians are divided on rape in some occasions. And in fact, the God of the Bible obviously endorsed rape on many occasions. So he's a bad role model. For example, when he went out and told his loving, holy warriors to go out and kill every man, woman, and child of this tribe, but save the young virgins alive. Read it in Numbers 31. Save the young virgin girls alive as war booty for his soldiers and for his priests. I think that's very, very close to rape.
So then you have this avoidance of unnecessary harm, this harm principle, which basically functions as a moral absolute, but you don't have a moral lawgiver.
It's not a moral absolute, no. I said it's relative to human needs. It's not an absolute.
Relative to human needs. Well, what human are we talking about? Are we talking about Hitler? Are we talking about somebody else? One of your debates, you referred to people like Timothy McVeigh and Hitler as crazies, and I would agree with you. But Christianity has a standard for what is sane and what is right. I don't see that standard in atheism.
Oh, you don't?
I don't see where you can get your unnecessary harm principle, where you can get this absolute. I mean, you're using it as an absolute, but it's just not there. It's not based in anything. If man is mere molecules of motion, what value is there to human life?
Because sentient beings in a natural environment naturally recoil from pain. It's part of our nature. We recoil from pain and harm. It's part of who we are. I assume that you're pretty much like me, that you recoil as well from pain and harm.
Very, very much so.
Therefore, relative to human needs, not absolutely in some big cosmic sense, but relative to us on this planet, in this environment, relative to our human needs and wants and desires, we can make a statement that is absolute relative to us, okay? That causing unnecessary harm is something to be avoided. And that's the essence of morality. There's nothing else there.
You're a nice guy. I'm a nice guy. Hitler and Stalin were not nice guys. How can you stand in judgment on them? I mean, you have some Attila the Hun humans who want to basically enslave people, kill people who disagree with them. You have no moral basis. You've removed the moral lawgiver. You ought to agree with Nietzsche that there are no absolutes. And then Nietzsche just said, basically the overmen just create their own values, and then Hitler took the ball around.
I can't believe you're asking this question. Hitler was wrong because he caused unnecessary harm. That's the principle, right?
Yeah, it's a principle consistent with Christianity, not with atheism.
No, it isn't. The God of Christianity caused a lot of unnecessary harm and bloodthirsty violence against innocent people. He said, happy shall you be to dash the innocent children against the stones. But let me answer your question. You asked me a question. Fortunately for the human race, there are enough of us on this planet who love life and value our life to protect ourselves from the few sick, crazy ones like Hitler. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. Fortunately, there are enough of us. We make laws. We have systems of self-defense, systems of justice. We have education. And we do as much as we can as possible to minimize that amount of unnecessary harm in the world. It's not that hard to figure out, and you don't need some code above it. Would it never dawn on the human race that there's something wrong with killing without the Ten Commandments?
Doesn't it strike you as obvious that if there is no perfection, there can be no imperfection? If you don't have the standard of goodness, there can be no violation or corruption of that? I mean, doesn't it just hit you between the eyes that you have to borrow from the Christian worldview?
Now, Barker will cross-examine Fernandez.
Okay, I already asked you one of the questions. Give me an example of a statement which, if true, would make your hypothesis false.
I think that if you could show, and you know, basically it's all based on my opening statement, but if you could basically show that the beginning of the universe, that atheism explains that more adequately than theism does, if you could explain...
But what? I mean, specifically, make a statement. Make a statement.
Well, making a statement. Give me some good evidence to believe that no God exists. I mean, the Big Bang cosmology. Robert Jastrow, who himself is an agnostic, admits that Big Bang cosmology, he referred to it in his book, God and the Astronomers, as scientists climbing, scaling the highest mountains, and when they got to the top, they found a band of theologians waiting there for centuries for them. It showed that the universe had an absolute beginning, the beginning of space, matter, and time.
So what you're saying then is that someday, if scientists do answer that question, you will reject your belief in a God.
That's only one of the things. I listed several reasons.
But
I'm
you
looking
will.
At I'm looking
okay,
at reality.
But if scientists do close that gap and we say, aha, now we know, you will reject your belief in a God? Will you? Will you be honest enough to say that your statement is falsifiable?
You're basically at this point, I want to say something. And you went into your subjective experience, but you did not use it as evidence against Christianity, and I want to tip my hat to you. At the same time, I am not using it. I'm saying this because he brought it up, okay? I am not using Jesus loves me, this I know, you know, he's in my heart, and I know he's in my heart, and that type of thing, and all. I'm sure at one time you really thought you had a personal relationship with Jesus and all, and some Christians would say you did, some would say you didn't.
I did, right?
But whatever the case, how much evidence would it take for Phil Fernandez to reject the existence of his brother? Hey, I met the dude personally. I knew him. I walked with him.
So it's not falsifiable to you, is what you're saying. There's no possible way to falsify.
Basically, how do you falsify? I think you could present good evidence that could maybe possibly, you know, refute me in a debate or whatever. But how can you prove to someone that another person doesn't exist when they've had a personal encounter and a personal relationship with
that person? So Jesus talks
to
you, and that's why you believe in him. He talks to you, and you have.
I believe in him before I heard him talking to me.
Oh, but he does talk to you.
I believe that God communicates to us in His Word, through circumstances, through prayer, and things of that sort.
Well, what I would
and
never.
And by the way, Thomas Aquinas did too, and he wasn't an idiot, so I don't think I should be pushed into that category.
Well, I used to make the same claim, so I know what you're saying. And I know that interreligious experience is very real. It's very powerful. I used to believe that Jesus was communicating with me, answering prayers and giving me this feeling of the Holy Spirit and direction in my life as I read the Bible. I know exactly what you're talking about, but I now know that it's false. Let me continue asking the question. I shouldn't be preaching here. I'm sorry. What if I were to be so silly as to say to you that I know in my heart of hearts, I have a personal experience that atheism is real, and I know there's no way you're going to talk me out of it. What would you say to my attitude?
Oh, I would say, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but I would say you're basically a person who is closed-minded in the sense that they're not open to the other options. And however, I'm closed-minded. You can't prove to me that my brother doesn't exist because I know him, personally walk with him. And it's the same with the God of the Bible. However, again, I'm not using this as evidence for Christianity. You asked me this question. So that's the only reason why I brought it up. I'm not telling you, because Jesus walks with me, accept him. This guy is asking questions, and I knew what street he was going down because he was walking down that street at one time.
What is God made out of? I mean, if he's not a physical thing, what is he?
Basically, I think you can make philosophers like J.P. Moreland with the mind-body arguments. I think that J.P. Moreland has provided ample evidence for non-physical entities that are real. For instance, a thought.
But a non-physical
how much
what?
How much does a thought weigh? Can you bounce it? What color is a thought?
Yeah, you can. A thought is a function of a physical brain. Without the brain, no thoughts exist.
Well, then we wouldn't be free. Because how can you hold me responsible for making a choice if it's just a physical reaction
but what is
inside
God,
my brain?
What's God made of? What is he an entity of? What is he?
God is a non-physical personal being.
How can there be a non-physical being? Now, what is it?
You're the one who assumes there can't be.
But what
I
is
argue
it?
That if the universe, if the space, matter, time universe had a beginning, but because from nothing, nothing comes, then the cause of the universe, by definition, must be immaterial, non-temporal.
Thank you very much.
This was the funnest part, I think. I think this was it.
I want to thank both Barker and Fernandes for being congenial and informative. I think both of them have provided a series of arguments from stretching from the last 2,000 years up to the last 20. I teach philosophy. I'm aware of many of the arguments for God's existence and many of the arguments against God's existence. I think they're doing an interesting job. I said we're going to have some time for audience questions. If you've got them formulated, please kind of line up at the mic. I'm going to lay some groundwork here. As you're walking up there, that's fine. Go ahead, just walk up. Let me do lay some groundwork. We've only got 20 to 30 minutes for this. I am really going to try to keep you on point. That is, if you start preaching one side or the other, we've got people here to take care of it. Okay, so I really love you. Come up with a question and let these fine gentlemen answer it.
Simple question to both of you. I'd like both of you to answer, if you would, is why aren't we wasting our time here? In talking about whether or not God exists, what difference... Why isn't this just a waste of time?
Do you want to go first or do you want me to?
Well, I did ask, what's the point of the discussion?
I think there's real, real good reasons for me being here. Because... if there's a pot of gold and I found it and I want to share it with my friends, there's all the reason in the world for me to be here and to proclaim that off the rooftops. At the same time, I really, to be honest with you, and Dan, I love you. As soon as we met, I watched your videos, fell in love with you, great guy. But I really don't know why you're here. I mean, if God doesn't exist, why devote your life? I mean, why you don't devote your life to refuting the Zeusites? So,
I feel no. Just one question. I feel exactly the same way. I feel like I'm sharing a pot of gold. I guess I was once a preacher, always a preacher. I feel like atheism is so special, so life-affirming, so superior morally to the Christian system, so more respectful of human dignity and human intelligence, that it's like a wonderful light was turned on in my life, much more than any born-again experience, much more than talking to Jesus, talking to God. I got to meet Steven Weinberg last November, and he talks the same way, that the beauty of learning about how the universe really functions can't compare to mythology and superstition and talking snakes and a vindictive God. Those are old ideas. Join the human race. Come, let's be brothers and breathe the same air of the same planet and try to work on this, solve the problems of this world, all right?
I didn't think it involved the scope of this debate, but I think that you opened the bag by discussing the idea of gaps in the evolutionary ladder, and I assume that you meant the fossil record. How old do you think the Earth is?
Be honest with you, I don't really know. I think there's real good arguments for the universe being between 15 to 18 billion years old from the Big Bang cosmology. At the same time, I think there's a lot of good. Now, I'm talking about an in-house debate among Christians, young Earth and old Earth. And science, from a scientific standpoint, I think the evidence seems to favor an old Earth at this point. But there's some biblical data that I'm having a hard time reconciling that with. And so there's some good young Earth arguments. But I think the evidence is stronger for an old universe. I'll just leave it at that.
I have an option, though, and I have 1 minute option to respond.
Yeah. Yeah.
This idea of irreducible complexity that you talked about with Behe has been thoroughly refuted. Irreducible complexity is a bad idea. Philosophers now are talking more about redundant complexity, and Behe and Dembski and them, they have some great selling Christian books out there, but they are not cutting it with philosophers or with scientists.
Sometime in the debate that the burden of proof is on the theist to make his or her case.
That's right.
And I want to ask you a question. A lot of philosophers are arguing that belief in God is sort of like perceptual experience, where we have an experience and we really don't have to give a case for that. We have that experience and we simply believe it. And I read recently in an encyclopedia that only 4% of the world population would agree to atheism, would claim to be atheistic. So it seemed to me that the atheist is more in the camp of the flat earthers, and we need to make the case, since more people seem to be theists. Why would you say that the theist bears the burden of proof in this argument?
Because if you're asking me to believe your belief, you can believe what you want, but if you're asking me to accept it, you have the burden of proof. Most atheists are simply people without a belief. We're not. When was the last time an atheist knocked on your front door trying to convince you to, you know what I mean? We're not out there saying, you've got to think like I do. We are being accosted all the time by people with a belief system, and it's your hypothesis, and it's not 4%, it's more like 20 to 25% of the world who do not believe in a God. Yeah, exactly, but actually 20 to 25% of the world do not believe in a God at all. In the United States, it's 7 to 9%, which is 20, 25 million. But so what? A majority of the world think that men are superior to women. Do we take a vote? You know, do we take a vote to see what's true or not? Do we see what the majority wants? There's a lot of things that the majority believes that get discarded after evidence and scientific proof throws them away.
I think, Dan, though, I think your answer is yes, we do take a vote when it comes to moral values.
No, I don't.
To get your harm principle, you just take and then you say anybody who disagrees with us is sick. And you should be grateful that theists like myself, maybe there are some theists, yeah, there probably are some real rotten theists and all, but at least theists like myself don't say, well, if you're an atheist, therefore you're sick and that type of thing because you disagree with, even at your 21%, you would still disagree with 79% of the people. There are primaries today. If I was running and I got 21% of the vote, I wouldn't be shouting that from the rooftops.
You'd win,
so,
yeah.
So there is a certain degree where it seems that you're pulling your moral values out of consensus. And everybody here, when he says killing innocent people is wrong, says, yeah, he's right. Well, why? Why do we think like that? And why do we know when there's a crazy out there, he's a crazy? And that's because God has written his laws within our hearts. The moral views that we just hold as human beings, okay, our knowledge of morality comes from an absolute moral being. But he says he just has a lack of belief. He doesn't have a positive belief. Did he sound like a guy with a lack of a system of thought and lack of belief? He's got his own worldview. It's called atheism. I've got my own worldview called theism, and I believe that theism is more reasonable than atheism is, and I gave several reasons why, and I think he has failed to refute those reasons.
Mr. Fernandez, you started out your arguments about with the principle of causality. And so you said that if there is a universe with man in it, then there must be a cause for that, and your cause is God. But if God exists, then there must be a cause or a creator of God. Now, what is that? A meta-God? And what is the nature of that God? And I think it's us, mankind. Philip Ingersoll said in the last century that the most noble, that an honest God is the most noble work of man. So, there you go.
I appreciate what you're saying, but unfortunately, sir, maybe I should mail you a copy of my opening statement because I refuted exactly what you're talking about. I refuted the possibility of an actual infinite set existing outside of a mind. By the way, the only mind that actual infinite set could exist inside of would be an infinite mind, i.e. God. That's a whole other point, but the fact of the matter is, you cannot have an infinite regress. There has to be a first cause. So whatever caused the universe, if that had a cause, you can't go back forever. Eventually, you have to arrive at the uncaused cause of all else that exists. Right. That's where the reasoning goes, right down that line.
I'm a mathematician. I kind of found very sophomoric all your mathematical arguments and stuff. Okay. One question and then one observation. I presume that you reject pantheism in favor of monotheism.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious.
Okay. Then maybe you can tell me why. A pantheism is the worship of many gods, and a monotheism, at least the Christian one, is a worship of one God with multiple personalities. How does one...
No, it's some forms of pantheism do take in some polytheism, but polytheism is the worship of many gods. Pantheism is the belief that God is the universe, God is everything. And it's pretty tough to try to prove. If I try to prove to you that pantheism is true, I would be one mind trying to persuade another mind that only one mind exists. So, I mean, it refutes itself right at the start.
One quick observation.
Next question.
No, please, let me, and then I'll finish. I'll get out of here.
Another question on math.
Sorry.
Hi, my question is for Dan. Dan, you said that you believe you're nicer than God, but you said you do not believe in God. So if you don't believe in God, how can you be nicer than God if you don't believe? You contradicted me.
Can I answer that question? For the same reason that you believe you're nicer than the Big Bad Wolf. The Big Bad Wolf is a literary character. The God of the Bible is a literary invention, a fictional character, and I'm nicer than that character.
Yeah, I'd like to make a statement that, hold on to your hearts, I don't want anybody to have a heart attack, but I do agree with him on this point. When he said that, I did not take it that he was positing the existence of a real God. He was basically saying, if your God exists, I'm nicer than him. Now, the fact of the matter is, I think he's wrong, but he was saying, you know, it was a hypothetical, and kind of an if he exists, then the so.
That question is for Dan, and it refers to the first question that you were asked in cross-examination about the milk running the combustion engine. And my question is, do you think that what you stated before in your speech, that you can't apply the rules that are made for within the set to the set itself, answers that argument?
I don't know. I was groping for an example. It might not have been a great example, but the thrust of his question was the hurricane blowing through a junkyard causing a Boeing 747, right? A single event. But no evolutionist, no biologist thinks that life evolved in one. You put a bunch of molecules in a bag and shake it up and out flies a butterfly. No one thinks that. That's a straw man. Very small successive changes over very long periods of time is what causes evolution to happen. So within the natural universe, we do see that. We see it happening all the time. We see it even with breeding of animals. We see those changes happening. So this idea of a 747 is cute, but it's a straw man. No one argues that.
You say this. That's not my argument. It's Hoyle's and with Gramsci. to the leading scientists of Great Britain. They were evolutionists until their studies led them to, and they're not creationists, by the way, or they're not Christians, but they do believe that intelligent design is necessary for the bringing about of life. And they're not saying it happened in one event, but what they're saying is that all this long, even with given 15 to 18 billion years and all that time, the chances of life evolving from non-life by chance, no matter how much time you got, Hoyles and Weir-Pramasinghe are saying, are about the same as the chance of a Boeing 747 being produced from a junkyard. So basically, you're just missing their point.
But in all honesty, you know they are an extreme minority. Most biologists accept a cumulative gradual evolution over time. We should move on here, though.
You said you referred to God and you said he. Why does he? Doesn't that kind of suppose that God doesn't have the powers of a woman, or that, you know, God is male and therefore can't do things that females can do?
That's a good question. I am not only a theist, but I'm a Christian theist. And in the Bible, it refers to God in the masculine pronoun. Now, having said that, I think you can make a very strong case that God has the best qualities of females and the best qualities of males, because there are times when it talks about God loving us, like a mother hen loves her chicks, okay? And so there are times when the illustrations that are giving of God's love is like a mother's love for her children, and the way Jesus wept over Jerusalem and things of that sort. In fact, I would argue that sometimes you find, not always, but sometimes you find guys are not sensitive enough, and sometimes you find some ladies that might be too sensitive. I think in Jesus you have the perfect balance. The sensitivity that is there, John 11:35, Jesus wept, but at the same time he knew when to stand up for something and when to refuse to compromise.
This is a good question for Mr. Barker. Doesn't your argument kind of fill the gaps? You were stating you was filling the gaps with God. Don't you just fill it with atheism? Aren't you doing the exact same thing? And how come you don't kind of suppose that, like he says, like God is our father and we are children, that maybe there are things we don't understand and we can't understand them. God understands them, but we don't. And you're kind of just filling the gaps with atheism.
Atheism is just leaving the gaps open. Atheism is just saying we're not going to knee-jerk fill it with our favorite religion. Atheism just says leave the gaps open. There are different kinds of atheists. In general, I'm a lowercase atheist who lacks a belief in a God, any kind of a God. But if you define God in a specific way, such as the God of the Bible, I am a capital A atheist. I know that that particular God does not exist because it cannot exist. I have a positive belief that that God doesn't exist. That doesn't mean that I can disprove all possible gods. So every atheist is an agnostic when it comes to, there's an infinite number. But regarding God being male, the reason Phil thinks God is a father is because the writers of the Bible were sexist men. They put down women. Jesus only had male disciples. It was only the 144 virgins. Only 12 disciples sat at the Last Supper. God got a woman pregnant, so right? And Virgin Mary got pregnant and it had a son, right? It's a very sexist, patriarchal book that you worship, that puts down, it devalues women. Women are valued less, and you should be ashamed to hold that book under your arm. But I'm responding to your answer. Excuse me, but I'm responding to your answer. It's his turn to ask a question.
He directed his second question to you, and so I was going to just respond to that. Just basically say that the Bible teaches that a woman was created in God's image. Atheism teaches that a woman evolved from primordial soup. She's just molecules of motion. So I think Christianity has a higher view of woman than atheism does.
Dan, just yes or no, you do not believe in the supernatural whatsoever?
No, I don't.
All right. My question is then, you claim to have once been with Jesus and preached and had experiences and all this cool stuff, right?
Yeah.
You want him to prove to you that God exists to fill in these gaps that you've left open? True?
If he wants to prove it to me, then that's what
Why
I'm asking him.
See, I don't believe you can be an atheist and be here, but my question is, prove to me that you had those experiences.
Well, if I was not a Christian, the Bible says, by their fruits ye shall know them, right? And my life exhibited all the fruits of the Spirit. I had many, many Christians come up to me and testify that they felt the Spirit of God in my life as I preached. People became saved and born again. There were altar calls when I preached. There are people in the ministry today who partly credit me as one of the reasons why they're in the ministry today. If I was not a Christian, if I wasn't real and sincere, and no one is, then Phil's not either. If I wasn't a true born-again Christian at that time, then nobody is, and you can't trust yourself either then.
I'm not arguing for any point of Christian or not. I'm just saying I'm not discrediting anyone or saying anyone is a Christian. Who am I to say? I'm saying you're saying you people came up and attested to your transformations or you what you just said. You had experience. I'm saying prove the experiences. Prove to me the experiences you claim. Prove to me that these people came up and did this and that.
But I don't want to. I don't have to. I mean, that's not my agenda. It's the agenda of Christians to prove...
No, but then why are you here? What is your agenda?
To show that belief in God is irrational and even dangerous. The world is better off without a belief in a God.
My question is for Dan, and I just have two questions. Number one is, you said... absolutely relative. What does that mean? If it's absolute, then it can't be relative, and if it's relative, it can't be absolute. So
no, I didn't say that. I mean, I said it is relative to human beings. We could make.
No, I heard you say the words absolute relative.
Well, okay, but relative to human beings, we can have universal value, right? Which we would call we could use the word absolute maybe, but of course we all every action is situational. But the principle of avoiding unnecessary harm, we could call that a universal human principle. So relative to us, we could call that an absolute, but not relative to the cosmos. There is no such thing as a moral value in the cosmos. So I see your point. I mean, those exact words do sound a little contradictory, but by explaining them, within a certain class of people, there can be universal opinions. And so within the class of human beings on this planet, there is a principle of the avoidance of unnecessary harm, which we can call, relative to us, a universal principle. But it's not cosmic.
See, the problem he's having there, okay? I can have universal moral values because I believe that those values come from the outside, from God, who is above all mankind. So whether Hitler agrees or not, those universal values are still universal. But how can you call moral values universal when guys like Hitler and Attila the Hun don't agree with them? Then it's not universal. It's senses. It becomes the majority. But again, your view is not in the majority, so I wouldn't go that route. I just would not go that route. You can't invent universals. They're either there because they're above all mankind, whether Hitler likes it or not, or they're not.
But I'm using the word universal in the sense of a set, right? A set, a universal...
A set of all the non-crazies, but you still don't have a definition of sanity.
Yeah, you do. People who routinely commit unnecessary harm, are something wrong with them. If you don't see that, then you don't understand morality.
I see that, but I have a basis for absolute morality. You don't. And my microphone is falling off.
I think the question's been addressed.
Secondly, do you believe in love?
Well, yes, but love is not a thing. I believe in love, and love is not something with a capital L that exists out in the cosmos somewhere. Love is a label for all sorts of different things. You'd have to define what you mean by...
Do you think that the word God could have the same kind of misunderstanding?
Well, then if God is just a synonym for love, then he's just a synonym for a natural thing. Love is just a label for a concept...
I didn't say he.
Okay, but love is just a label for a concept which could be... sexual love, family love, love for your country, appreciation, admiration, respect. I believe that those real things in the real world exist, and the label that we put on them is called love. But love itself is not a thing. It doesn't exist anywhere.
Well, see, I think love does exist because the loving God, from him comes love. So that love is a real thing. It's not something you can pick up and bounce because all real things aren't physical, okay? love is an abstract thing, but it's a real thing, okay? It's a non-physical entity that is real, like spirit. Now, with him, what he's saying, if I'm understanding correctly, love is some kind of squirt in the brain, okay? You just get this, you know, some kind of chemical reaction inside your brain, but that's very dangerous because then you can do the same with hate. So when Timothy McVeigh, if he's right, Timothy McVeigh did what he did because certain events happened in his brain that were totally out of his control. If I am right, Timothy McVeigh stands condemned before an all-holy, all-just God.
We have 5 minutes for Dan Barker to give closing statements, and then 5 minutes for Fernandez.
Somebody asked tonight, why are we doing this? And, well, that's a good question. I mean, if God exists, shouldn't the question have been settled by now? Why are we still having these debates? If there's anything that's obvious, now be honest with yourself, if there's anything that's obvious, the existence of God is not obvious. It's not something that we obviously know is true, or else we atheists would know it. Imagine if scientists were to gather together every Sunday morning and hold hands and sing, "Yes, gravity is real. I know that gravity is real. I will have faith. I will be strong. I will resist the devil. I know in my heart that what goes up, up, up must come down, down, down. Amen." You know, I mean, wouldn't you think they were pretty insecure on the concept? I mean, and yet that's kind of what most believers in their heart of hearts know, that there's something fishy about what they believe. And they know it's not obvious. They know it's not easy to show to anyone else. They know it's a faith thing. And yet if faith is valid, well, then anything can be true. All the religions are true. Anytime you have to accept an assertion by faith, you're admitting that that assertion cannot be accepted on its own merits. You're admitting basically an agnosticism. Faith is a form of agnosticism. Because if you knew something's true, you don't need faith. Bertrand Russell went on to say, Phil quoted Bertrand Russell from a speech that he gave called A Free Man's Worship. Bertrand Russell did say, yes, the only true basis for morality is based on ultimate despair, because the universe is going to cool off. And end, by the way, you're wrong to suggest the second law of thermodynamics suggests an end. It only suggests an equilibrium. It could exist forever. But Bertrand Russell went on to say that you can build a meaning and morality and happiness on that foundation of despair. And it's a more meaningful one than a pie-in-the-sky morality. Bertrand Russell said, happiness is no less happy because it doesn't last forever. In fact, doesn't rarity increase value? Doesn't brevity increase value? If things last forever, well, then they're cheap. If life is eternal, then it's cheap. If we have an eternal life after this, then so what? Then this life loses its value. It loses its preciousness. It loses the beauty of this brief existence that we have. Before I was born, there was an eternity of time when I didn't exist. Didn't bother me one bit. Same will be true after I'm dead. We live now. This world needs our attention. If there is some kind of a God, well, let him take care of his own world. This is the world that needs our attention. This is the world that needs the improvement. This is the world where we need to put our energies. A lot of Christians are afraid that people will think for themselves. The Bible says that. The Bible says very clearly, bring every thought into captivity unto the obedience of Christ. Take no thought for tomorrow. Lean not on your own understanding. The Bible is very anti-thinking. Submit like a slave. Paul was happy to call himself a slave over this master above him. But we atheists are afraid that people won't think for themselves. We think thinking for yourself is a beautiful gift. It's the pot of gold. Somebody asked for a support system. I don't know who you are. You could join the Freedom from Religion Foundation, the group that I represent that works to keep state and church separate. We are atheists and agnostics. You can find us on the web at ffrf.org if you like. Or there are some local humanist free thought groups here in the Seattle area. Since Phil didn't give us any evidence for his hypothesis, I'm still justified in not believing it. He didn't give us any evidence for the existence of moral absolutes. He just said that they exist, but he didn't give us an example. He didn't give it, well, he mentioned rape, but even rape, according to some Christian theology, a Christian husband to his wife. might sometimes feel that he has the right to have unwanted sexual intercourse with her. Some Christians might disagree with rape even in that way. I think what this debate boils down to basically is your view of human nature. Christianity and most forms of theism are a put down to human nature. We are no good. We can't think. We need a master above us to tell us what it's all about. Jesus died for our sins because we're all deserving of hell. We are no good. We're little worms. All these hymns about worms. But atheists and humanists tend to think positive and optimistic about human nature. Didn't Jesus say, he who is whole doesn't need a physician? Well, I don't need the physician. I feel whole. I feel complete. I'm not omniscient and all-powerful, but I am happy with this life that I have found myself with, and I feel capable in it. I don't need a master. I don't need a Lord. I'm not a sinner. I don't feel bad. I don't feel guilty about that. And I think people who do are diminishing the beauty and the value of life. Steven Weinberg said, and I'll close with his quote. Steven Weinberg, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist who brought together the electroweak force, if you know that, he spoke at our convention last November. And he said, religion is an insult to human dignity. With it or without it, you would have good people doing good things and evil people doing evil things. But for good people to do evil things, that takes religion.
Okay, first I'd like to apologize to those people who asked those good questions, but there's about 12 of them that were directed at me, and that would take up more than the 5 minutes that I have. Each one, and to be honest with you, each one deserves about a 20-minute answer. So I apologize that I'm not going to be able to answer those questions, though I don't think any of the questions that you asked stumped me. I think there are good, solid answers, but you ask a $50 question, you need a $50 answer, and we don't have time for that right now. Basically, I think the reason why there's some people that don't believe and some people that do is because there's a struggle, there's a thirst within our hearts for something more than this human experience, okay? I believe that's a thirst for God that only Jesus can quench, okay? But there's also a drive for human autonomy. Now, the atheist, taking the Freudian line, is going to say that we invented God by wishful thinking. We projected this father image, okay? We worship the father image. Paul Vitz, a psychologist, says Freud was wrong. It's atheists who want to kill the father image. So you got both camps saying, hey, you guys are neurotic and all. I think from the Christian standpoint, I would say we have a drive for human autonomy. We want to be our own gods. We want to be our own kings. But there's also a thirst for God. I think that's the essence of free will. He says that the second law of thermodynamics, we can go on forever and ever. Yeah. But in a state of equilibrium with totally useless energy, if that's all that atheism has to offer you, I mean, that's not, I mean, when all energy is all used up, I mean, that's a lot to look forward to. I don't know, he talked about Hitler being a Christian. You need to research this. You need to research this a lot closer. Anybody, their mother's brother calls himself a Christian. But Jesus said, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, runs into the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven, which, by the way, is in the context of the passage, you shall know them by their fruits. But whatever the case, 1 Peter 3:15, Colossians 4, 5, and 6, 2 Corinthians 10, the Bible is filled with passages that tell Christians to use reason and to defend the Christian faith. I provided good evidence. Oh, but on the case of Hitler, he agreed with the Thule Society, with the German Volk religion, with the Theosophical cult. They even got the swastika from Helena Blavatsky and the Theosophical cult. That Hitler's religious views, he believed Jesus was not Jewish. He was the greatest Aryan male who ever lived. And he believed that mankind was spiritually evolving, so he was an evolutionist too, New Age evolutionist type thing. And they're going to bring about this New Age, but they got to get rid of all the non-Aryans, all the subhumans. That is not Christian, and it never was Christian. But one thing about Hitler, he was a good politician. And he knew that if he was going to try to deceive the people, he'd have to at least make them think he was coming from a respectable position, and so he perverted the Christian faith. I gave good evidence for God's existence. The Big Bang model shows that space, matter, and time had a beginning. Therefore, the cause of the universe, since from nothing, nothing comes, the cause of the universe must be non-spatial, immaterial, non-temporal, and extremely powerful. A lot more power than nothing has. I argued from the continuing existence of the universe that the universe needs a totally independent being to sustain the existence of the universe. The design and order in the universe and irreducible complexity is like a mousetrap. You take one part away, it doesn't function. Okay? And that's what Michael Behe is talking about. He's saying the irreducible complexity found on the molecular level is as complex as a spaceship. Okay? So Dawkins and these other characters that are out there trying to refute him, I think they better hold on to their seats. And by the way, Michael Behe is a theistic evolutionist. So don't throw him in the evangelical crazy camp with Phil Fernandez. So the design and order in the universe shows the universe needs an intelligent designer. The reality of absolute moral laws. You heard it from his mouth that raping people is not universally absolutely wrong, but we kind of call it universally wrong. No, look, either God and absolute morality or no God and no absolute morality. Either, and I'll close with this, either in the beginning God or in the beginning nothing. That's the choice that we have to make. I think I've shown theism to be more reasonable than atheism in these separate areas. And atheism looks at these separate areas and either says they're just there, admits they're there and says they're just there, moral absolutes are just there, or it tries to explain them away. Moral absolutes aren't really absolutes, and so rape, racism, and things of that sort are not really wrong. Thank you, and God bless.
Quick hands.
Really. Had a good time. Had a good time.
Yeah, great time.
It was really very intellectually stimulating.
Yeah, you're a good talker.
Speaking once again for the Philosophy Club here at BCC, I really want to say thank you to Dan Barker and Phil Fernandez. You guys are respectful of the audience, and the audience, I think you guys deserve a hand too because you're respectful for them. We have an issue here that I'm sure polarizes some people, but we got some interesting ideas. Thank you very much for coming.